This is a CBC original podcast.
It is not glamorous in war. Not for anyone, and certainly not for journalists. Iraq was the first place that I smelled burning human flesh. And when you smell that, you know what it is. You know long before you see it. In this case, it was coming across Iraqi soldiers who had been bombed in place and were completely obliterated, who sometimes had been in vehicles that got hit, ran out of those vehicles on fire, and died by burning to death. War zones have two speeds. There's the adrenaline moments and there's the boring moments. And the boring moments outweigh the exciting ones. And it's just the nature of the beast. We waited for more than 2 months for the war to start. And then when it did, it was go, go, go. And then absolute chaos. But let me start at the beginning. I'm David Common, and this is Backstory, the Iraq Invasion 2003.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
George Bush like kill people, especially in Iraq, for the oil.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
The oil is for our country, for our people, not for George Bush.
These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
The reason the Americans, and to a lesser degree the Brits, went to war in Iraq, decided to invade, was under this pretense that there were weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical hordes that would be released if someone didn't go in and take care of this, that it was a duty that the world cop had to go in.
The United States knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
And they went in.
Any country on the face of the earth with an active intelligence program knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
And they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. What we have had since is more than a decade of absolute chaos, and it was chaotic, certainly, at the time. I went in as a producer. I got a phone call asking me if I would go in and be a producer for a correspondent, Patrick Brown, and work with a videographer, Glenn Kugelstadt. And I was not high on the list. They'd actually gone through a number of other people and asked, will you go to war? Will you go and produce Patrick Brown? And a lot of people had said no for a whole bunch of reasons, some of which were, look, there's this all this talk of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, chemical weapons. Could they be used in this kind of environment? For us to go, we had to wear these or bring these chemical suits and gas masks that you were supposed to be able to get on in something like 9 seconds. Nobody ever could. What if it was a nerve agent? Could you get it on before your lungs essentially stop working, before your arms stop working enough that you could get the suit further on, that you could get the gas mask on? Would you be able to react quickly enough? I was a young guy in my 20s and looking to advance my career and looking to have an adventure and said, of course.
The ground war begins. U.S. Marines launch a barrage of artillery and cross the border from Kuwait into Iraq.
At one point on, it may have been the night of the invasion starting, it might have been the night after. I remember we were down on the front line and it was, you know, midnight or 1 a.m. We were trying to get this video link up with our offices in Canada so that Patrick Brown, the correspondent, could go on the air. But in order for us to do that, you know, we have to turn on all this equipment, which lights up, which makes noise. We make noise doing it. And we know the Iraqi Republican Guard has that day been just tens of meters, certainly within a rifle's shooting distance of where we now are. And you just have to wonder, are they going to open fire on our position? Because they know exactly where we are. Well, what's going through my mind is that we're going to get killed. or we're going to get hurt. And so the aim is, let's do this, let's do it fast, let's do it right, and let's get out of there. And that's precisely what we did. But you do have this fear because you just don't know. And it was a real kind of, we do these risk-reward ratios. What risk are we taking and what are we going to get for taking that risk? And this was borderline. Was it worth the risk to do what we were doing? Darkness is scary. You're back to being a kid. How scared you get from the dark, because you just don't know what's out there and how you can't turn around. If you hit a gunfight, if you hit a roadblock, if you hit any number of things, there's no getting out of it at night. You're not going to see it until it is way too late. And so there were certainly lots of instances where you do feel unsafe. Then there's the bank robbery. We get to Mosul in Iraq, and we go straight to the town square, figuring that's going to be where the action is. We get there, and we're with a driver, and we had said to this driver, do not leave us. We're going to get out of the car, and we're going to do some filming, but do not leave us. So he parks just off to one side of the square, and we walk off, and we start doing some filming, and then gunfire starts. It's a bank robbery. There's a bank robbery going on in the middle of an invasion. So there is in this square a Bank of Iraq, a place where gold bars are held. So bank robbers show up, start shooting at the guards. The guards start shooting back. There's bullets everywhere. It's not like a normal gunfight where bullets go in one direction and then back in the other. They're just going all over the place. The bank robbers are on different sides of the square. And it's at this point that you establish, before you go into a place, what is our exit strategy? And our exit strategy was, get back to the car. And the car's just on the edge of the square. And so we look across the square, and he hasn't left us. He has stayed in the square, and the hood of the car is now being used by one of the bank robbers as cover, and he's firing from the hood of our car with our driver, and is just totally at ease with the fact that someone's using his hood as a gun nest. And so there is this shot of me running through the square as these bullets are being fired, screaming,
back, 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 back.
Get back. And he backed out of there. As he said to us after the fact, I'd committed to you. I said I wouldn't leave. So I didn't. Patrick, the correspondent, is desperate to get to Tikrit. It is the town that is the center of Saddam's power. It's where he was born. It's ultimately where he was found in that spider hole. And it is where, along the banks of the river, he has this massive, beautiful new palace. And you can see it from forever away. And so we see it as we're driving towards it. But now we're getting into the territory where fighter jets are operating, where the coalition war effort in the sky is visible, and you're seeing bombed out military vehicles. You're seeing bombed out bridges. One bridge we crossed had a giant hole in it, and so for our vehicle to kind of get to where we were going, we had only three tires on the ground at the time, so you had to drive through the hole. And we pull up at the palace in Tikrit, and we're 2 minutes behind the U.S. Marines.
The Marines came to Tikrit. The rest of it's just details.
And then comes the major disappointment. We come across a sergeant.
We came up, had to shoot a couple people.
Who seems to be telling people what to do, and at this point helicopters are starting to land on the gardens.
Tikrit now belongs to the Iraqi people again, no longer to Saddam.
So we see him, and we just grab our equipment, and we start heading into the palace, because we think, okay, you know what, we'll maybe film a little bit of them clearing the palace. And sergeant says, no, gentlemen, you cannot go in there. And you knew you were going to change his mind. I happen to see a Humvee pull up, and it's got stars on the door. And I think, that's different. And I go up, and there's a Marine general there. And he pulls up, and he sees us, and he comes up to me. He says, where y'all from? I say, we're from Canada. He says, Canada, I love Canada. Where are you from in Canada? And I said to him, oh, you're not going to know it. And he said, oh, try me, try me. And I say, yeah, I live in the city of Regina. He goes, Regina, I've been there. I said, what? What's going on? How am I talking to a General Yosemite Sam of the U.S. Marines in Tikrit, Iraq, and he has been to Saskatchewan? It just didn't add up. And so it turns out he hunts snow geese, which in Saskatchewan, they're plentiful. Lots of people hunt them. And so he talks about that very briefly. I pull out my Saskatchewan driver's license. I prove that we're there. Finally says, what y'all doing here? I said, oh, well, you know, we're Canadian journalists, and we were hoping to go into the palace. And he said, oh, yeah, it sounds like a great story. Why don't you should do that? And I said, well, the sergeant over here said we can't do that. He just says, listen, boy, I'm a general. I way outrank that sergeant. Y'all want to go in? Y'all are going in. Sergeant, get over here. Sergeant comes running over. He says, sergeant, get yourself a rifle party together. These men have a lot of equipment. They need to carry it in. And so we go in. The slight disappointment is that I don't know that it had been looted prior to their arrival, but there was basically nothing in there. But the one thing that was very memorable, and I'm sure got looted by someone after the fact, solid gold toilets. 2.5 months in Iraq, basically waiting for the war to start, just slightly under that. And then suddenly it starts, and after months of preparations and doing stories about what was happening in that part of Iraq in the buildup, to be inside Saddam's palace was just weird. I'll always remember it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
In downtown Baghdad this morning, we're seeing evidence of the collapse of any central regime authority. The streets are full of people celebrating.
This is a process that takes some time, and when it's over, the regime will be gone.
If we are wrong, we will have destroyed a threat that at its least is responsible for inhuman carnage and suffering. That is something I am confident history will forgive.
This could probably be qualified as one of the largest foreign policy bungles ever seen.
You know, people ask me, oh, you went to Iraq. You must have been scared. It must have been really bad. And I say, you know what? It was the best time to go there. And it was because it got so much worse, so fast, for so long, and endures to this day. There was the sectarian violence. Now it's given way to ISIS and the absolute horrors of that. As bad as Saddam was, there was a glue factor to him. And that's not an argument to keep him, but it is an argument to understand what happens when you remove that glue. It was glue by force. It was an anvil dropped on the people of Iraq and that region. But that anvil kept down the horrors that we now see. There's a direct connection between ISIS and the Baathists, the people who ran Iraq at the time. The reason they're so good militarily, in part, is because they had very well-trained Iraqi officers who helped start that organization. I never went back and never wanted to. Young men in their 20s do stupid things, and they take a lot of risks that you wouldn't take later in life. The mentality that someone else will be hit and not me. And certainly I was infected by that young man in his 20s reality at that time. And I didn't feel like I was taking on any huge risk. Don't get me wrong, there were times I was scared, really scared. But it didn't say to me, I shouldn't be here, or I shouldn't accept this assignment in the first place. Would I do something like that today? The guy who's married, the guy who has 2 kids? It's unlikely. But I've always said that if you go to a war zone and you're one of the scared ones, you're one of the good ones to be with. It's the people who don't have fear you don't want to be anywhere near. They're the most dangerous. Backstory is recorded and produced by Cecil Fernandez. I'm David Kalman.
For more CBC Original Podcasts, go to cbc.ca/originalpodcasts.